Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Max Wilbert. He's an activist, photographer, and writer based in Salt Lake City. Although he's only 25 years old, he's been working against racism, social injustice, war, and environmental issues for over a decade. So thank you so much, Max, for agreeing to be on the program.
Thanks, Derek. It's really good to be here.
Well, thanks. So the first question really is, what I want to talk today about is the green technology. You recently gave a talk at an environmental conference about green technology and why it's not the solution to the problems that we face. Can you explain why you say that?
Sure. Yeah. So I don't know about you, but I think I have a similar experience to many environmentalists. When I first got started doing environmentalism, one of the main avenues that was presented to me for ways to, you know, fight to defend the planet was to work for green energy, things like solar panels and wind turbines and so on. And it really made sense to me at the time, but now with a little bit more information, I think that a lot of the reason that that made sense was because it was a carefully crafted narrative. I was basically being sold a story. I was being sold an advertisement, essentially. And I think that most environmentalists have fallen victim to this essentially an advertising campaign that's been put on by green technology companies. It's been supported by governments, the Department of Energy. It's been supported by mainstream environmental groups like Greenpeace and the Sierra Club. And I think it's really it's based on a few fundamental flaws that really change the way that I look at green technology now. So I think the first thing you have to understand when you're looking at these green technologies is that they're industrial products, essentially. A lot of people, when they look at a wind turbine, you know, spinning in the middle of a bright green field, they can look at that and say, okay, there's no pollution happening there. There's no destruction happening there. That looks nice. It looks clean. But the problem is you're only looking at one small part of the process there. You're essentially looking at the place where energy is produced. But what you're not looking at is the place where these wind turbines are constructed, where the raw materials are gathered and extracted from the earth. So there's a lot more going on behind the scenes. So in the talk that I gave recently on this subject, I spoke about sort of lifting back that veil and exposing what's going on, what's being hidden from us about these technologies. And I live in Salt Lake City right now, as you mentioned, and I'm not sure if you're aware of this. You probably are. I imagine that you've been here. There's a huge copper mine just outside of Salt Lake City. It's one of the largest copper mines in the world. And essentially, it's a mountaintop removal mine. So it's the exact same type of strip mining that you see in Appalachia for coal. But they're taking out copper here. And in doing my research for this talk I gave, I found out that I looked at one specific wind turbine, which was a 1.5 megawatt wind turbine made by General Electric, one of the most common turbines in use around the world today. And I found that each one of these turbines has about 700 pounds of copper just used in the generator portion of the turbine. That's not to mention copper used in other places, like in the wiring. But when I see environmentalists promoting these wind turbines, I rarely hear them talking about the impacts of the raw materials that are needed for these technologies. So, you know, you can't have a wind turbine without copper. Another example is steel. You know, steel is one of those things we don't talk about very much. It's kind of ubiquitous in the global economy. The World Bank actually looks at steel as a fundamental marker of economic development, quote unquote. So unless your country is consuming a certain amount of steel per person per year, then you're considered underdeveloped. I think that number is several hundred pounds. It might have been several hundred tons. I'm not sure, but it was a lot either way. So steel, I decided in my talk to highlight the largest sources of the materials that are used in these turbines. So I looked at the largest iron ore mine in the world, and it's in Brazil. It's in the middle of the Amazon rainforest, and it's a huge strip mine. It essentially looks the same, again, as the mountaintop removal mines in Appalachia. So they're cutting down thousands of acres of forest there every year. They're polluting the water with mercury. There's huge emissions of greenhouse gases and other pollutants from the machinery and the transportation and the refining process. So if you add it all up, what you basically see is that these technologies, which appear to be green, which have been presented to us as these green saviors, I talked about them in my talk as the great green hope of environmentalists. What you see is that they really require devastation on a huge scale in order to be produced. And I think that's a fundamental contradiction that most environmentalists and most people in general who promote these technologies aren't taking into account.
Well, I remember reading somewhere that Bill McKibben said that the choice, I mean, there's also the fact that wind turbines hurt birds and bats and insects and many other species. But I remember reading Bill McKibben say that the choice is not really between windmills and bats. The choice is between an oil economy and a wind economy. And what struck me in that discussion was that he was willing to sacrifice birds and bats and everyone else who is victim to the wind energy machines, because he didn't seem willing to question the actual industrialization itself. So it seems sometimes we're presented with a sort of false choice. I just received a couple of emails from some guy a couple of days ago that he was saying, so gosh, well, first off, it's very interesting. He said that my work has been used by a global warming denialist to support his work. And I wrote back and said, for crying out loud, how? Because I talk about global warming a lot. And he said, well, basically, my understanding was that the guy was saying that I don't like wind energy. And so somehow that's fueling this weird global warming denialist creed somehow. But anyway, the point is that I wrote back and said, well, that's nonsense. You know, the fact that I'm not in favor of industrialized wind energy does not mean that I don't believe global warming is happening. He wrote back and said, well, what do you think we should do? And I said, well, I don't believe we should go for the lesser of two evils. And he got really pissed off at me and was, I'm just sort of rambling. I mean, take this wherever you want.
Right. Yeah, totally. When I was thinking about this, issue a lot lately as I was doing research, and I was reminded of the quote from Malcolm X, and I just read the new biography by Manny Marable, which was really great, and I thought provided a very nuanced history of him, which I wasn't aware of all that before, and was really just fascinating all around. And of course, I have some issues with Malcolm X in terms of misogyny and other things, but the quote that I really love from him is, if you stick a knife into my back 9 inches and you pull it out 6 inches, that isn't progress. And that's essentially what we're being faced with. I mean, you said it well, that it's a false choice. People are, like Bill McKibben, are saying we've got this choice between fossil fuels and green energy. And I think that's a completely false choice. And I think that, as you have said very well before, the only way out of a double bind is to smash it. And I think that that's very much true in this case. If you accept that choice, that dichotomy between green energy and fossil fuels, then you're making a bunch of assumptions right off the bat. You're assuming that we need industrially produced electricity. You're assuming that we want it. You're assuming that it's worth the cost. You're making a long series of assumptions that aren't even stated.
And the costs are, of course, paid not by us, but paid by the people, the human and non-human people who are the victims of this. So it's not even really fair for us to talk about a cost-benefit analysis, because the real costs are being foisted on others.
Right, exactly. And that's definitely the case if you look at rare earth metals, which are also required for wind turbines, solar panels, electric cars. They're in computer hard drives, cell phones, almost every technology that we think of as a sort of modern advanced technology requires rare earth metals. And the largest source of those is in Western China. 95% of the supply is mined there. And a large portion of the workforce is people who have been forcibly removed from their homes in Tibet and brought to these work camps. And Tibet had a population of 6 million people, and they've lost one-fifth of the population that's essentially been worked to death by the Chinese state. So that's 1.2 million people, and that's doing things like uranium mining, coal mining, as well as rare earth mining. So, yeah, that's what's required for this sort of clean, green energy revolution that is so popular and so unexamined in the wealthier nations like the U.S., where we are.
And there's this also the whole exploration of green energy, so-called green energy, really, for me at least, it signals a huge change in a devaluation, co-optation of environmentalism that I found extremely distressing over the last 20, 30 years. And Paul Kingsnorth talks about this, and other people talk about it, that at one point, environmentalism was supposed to be about, and really was, about protecting the places and creatures and plants we love from this horrible culture. And somewhere along the way, environmentalism got, the whole meaning of it got co-opted into trying to continue this destructive way of living a bit longer through means that seem greener. But as always, it is the poor and the indigenous and the non-human who end up paying. And that transformation, I find, whatever word we should use, that it's far worse than troubling.
Right. Definitely. Yeah, and I think it's a great example of how civilization, and especially capitalism, is really very skilled at taking energy that is opposed to it, fundamentally opposed to it, and redirecting it into a way that actually supports it and buttresses the system. I'm primarily concerned about the natural world when it comes to the environment. I'm not too worried about sustaining the industrial economy and the capitalist economy. I'm much more worried about, you know, yesterday I just saw a peregrine falcon flew over my head, just about 15 feet overhead. And that's the first time that's ever happened to me, and it was completely breathtaking. And I ran to the other side of the house and got my binoculars and went outside and watched her for a while. And, you know, really, I'm much more concerned about peregrine falcons than I am about having fancy electric cars. I think, you know, another example that springs to mind is I was driving yesterday and I was listening to the radio, and the radio was on some pop, you know, popular music station, and I heard this song that I kind of liked. I had never heard it before, and it was catchy. So I looked it up when I got back home today because it was stuck in my head. And so I looked it up on YouTube, and I watched the music video, and of course it was just your typical popular song. You know, there were a lot of scantily clad women, you know, dancing around, and, you know, men in suits sort of participating in the objectification and celebrating the objectification of women. And it reminded me of this particular issue with green technology, because it's another example of how movement for change in terms of women's empowerment and control of their own bodies and their own sexual decisions has been almost completely co-opted into this form of, you know, quote-unquote empowerment that seems to really just uphold the status quo of men sexually dominating women and exploiting them as a class around the world.
Let's go back to wind and or solar and talk more about some of the particulars of the problem. And you've talked about some of the problems on the materials end. You want to talk at all about some of the problems on the actual production end? Not production of the windmill, but production of energy, the generation end, I should say.
Sure. Are you talking about in terms of efficiency and how these green energies compare to fossil fuels, or am I misunderstanding?
Well, that's one direction to go. And another direction to go would be the actual effects on non-humans of the generation of electricity at the windmill or the solar production facility.
Right.
And so let's go both directions with that. Why don't you first go the direction you wanted to go and then second go the other direction?
Well, I don't actually really want to go the first direction because I'm not really that concerned about it. I think that there's a lot of evidence that shows that solar and wind and these technologies could never really replace fossil fuels because they're not dense, they're not easily stored, et cetera. But I'm not really interested in that because even if they were, I'd still be opposed to them. So I'm more interested in the second direction, the impacts on other creatures.
Well, good. And that's the direction I really wanted to go anyway.
Cool. Great. So, you know, we hear a lot about the effects of wind turbines on birds, and there definitely is an effect. If you're talking about all the global impacts on bird populations, it's relatively small. You know, things like domestic cats kill way more birds than wind turbines do at this point, at least according to the data that I've seen, which, of course, I have no idea, actually, whether the data is good or how well that research has been done or anything. But it's a relatively small number, but, I mean, that's not the point, really. The point is that, you know, do we as environmentalists, as people who care about the living world, do we actually want to promote yet another system of energy or another technology that inevitably leads to bird deaths? And of course, the impact on bats is much worse than the impact on birds.
And of course, bats are being hammered by a number of other causes too, as are birds.
Right, of course.
And part of the way I look at cats are terrible, cell phones are terrible, sky rises are terrible, one of the ways I look at that is that if you have a person who is suffering from multiple systems failure in their body, I mean, it can be a fairly small disease that actually pushes them over the edge into death. And so the point is, it seems to me absolutely atrocious when migratory songbird populations are already collapsing to add a new technology in that's going to add additional stress to them. I mean, that seems completely the wrong direction to go.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It would be like somebody coming to my house with a knife, and I'd already been stabbed, and I was being stabbed repeatedly, and they said, "Oh, it's okay. We're going to switch to a new system where instead of stabbing you, we're just going to cut you all over your arms or something like that."
Right.
And expecting that to be a good thing. Yeah, definitely. And in terms of solar, there are a lot of impacts. One of the biggest ones is that all these corporations, these solar corporations, are installing solar, these big solar projects. One of the biggest, I think the biggest in the world, just came online in California, called the Ivanpah. And that one is a solar thermal power plant. And they installed it in the desert. It's on the east side of the Sierra Mountains. And they installed it right on top of a bunch of habitat for the desert tortoise, which is a threatened species. And they estimate that installation of this one project killed 3,000 or more of these desert tortoises, most of whom were likely killed without the humans who were doing the work even having any idea that it was happening. And of course, with this solar thermal, it's pretty popular, increasingly popular in various areas around the world, especially desert, sunny desert regions. Another big issue there in terms of birds is that solar thermal uses these mirrors to concentrate sunlight and direct it towards a tower in the center of the facility, where it heats water, and the water turns to steam, and that runs a turbine, which generates electricity. But the concentrated solar energy, any bird that flies through there basically gets fried. And so already they've found dozens of birds who've had their wings burned off, who have been killed by this solar project.
And whenever I think about anything like that, I think about a line by Georges Monbiot, where he was arguing after Fukushima in favor of additional nuclear power plants. And one of the things he said was, basically, if we don't have all these nuclear power plants, how are we going to get the energy that we need to run our factories? And one of the ways I think about this is how different that would sound if he changed a couple of words. And instead, he said, how are the capitalists going to get the energy that they need to run their factories?
Exactly. Yeah.
Because it's not, the birds aren't being killed for you or for me, because the percentage of energy use by individuals is actually fairly small compared to industry.
Right.
Just as with waste production, just as with water use. And so really these birds are being sacrificed so they can make new computers, so they can make new cars, so they can keep the industrial economy running.
Right. Yeah, definitely. And I'm sorry, go for it.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, you know, I actually have no real problem with people who have small solar power systems on their homes or something like that. You know, there are one of my people who I work with in activism that I do just returned from the Philippines, and they were doing some speaking around the country, but they're also doing relief work after Typhoon Haiyan. I don't know how to pronounce that correctly. But the typhoon that went through there recently, that was one of the strongest storms ever known. And they were installing, they were bringing solar power back to some of these highly impacted areas. And, you know, that's not I'm not really too worried about that on the scale of the global economy and global electrical generation, because we've got bigger fish to fry. And so, you know, if these energy technologies were being implemented in a really small scale way as part of a strategic plan to quickly reduce fossil fuel use and eventually transition in a short time to a sustainable way of life, then I'd actually probably be behind them. I'd be supporting that. But that's not what we're seeing at all. We're seeing them put in place to support the status quo, as you said.
So what do you want for people to do? How do you want? I mean, you've offered up a critique here of wind and solar power, both in their production, in the production, the materials in production, and then also in the actual generation. But so what do you want people to do with this information?
Right. Well, that's the question, isn't it? Some people, when I bring up these topics, they just get really upset and angry at me because I'm sort of smashing their hopes and dreams, and they really want something to replace that.
Well, wait,
and I think
before you answer the question I just asked, why don't you talk about that for a second and say, you've offered a critique here, and now give me some of the critiques of your critique.
Sure. Yeah, so that's one of the big ones. People say, well, what are we going to do then? And I think the reason people are so angry is because green energy offers a really easy way out, or it seems to offer a really easy way out. You know, it seems to say you can have your cake and eat it too, basically. And you can have your industrial technology, you can have your electricity, you can have your comfortable lifestyle, and you can also save the planet at the same time. And so in some ways, the message that I'm bringing is a big bummer to those people, because I'm telling them that that's not true, that a modern industrial lifestyle is incompatible with life on this planet, and there's no technology that you can use to fix the way out of that problem. But the people who I don't think get as angry about this is, you know, the 50% of the world's population that doesn't have electricity. And I think it's easy to forget, living in the U.S., that that the baseline here is very privileged compared to many areas around the world, and that many people live happily and healthy, wonderful lives without industrial technology, and that's very much possible. So I think that's one of the main critiques that I've gotten. Let's see, I think another main critique that I get is just that technology will solve the problem. Just that, you know, even if it's the case that that you need mining, that these technologies kill birds, that we'll come up, our ingenuity will come up with a way to fix it. And people often ask the question about recycling. They'll say, you know, well, we don't need mining because we can just recycle all the metals and we'll get more and more efficient with our recycling and then we won't need to do mining. And of course, there again is the same language that you were just pointing out in terms of we. Because, of course, it's not we. I know you don't participate in recycling copper scrap into raw copper, and neither do I. And
in any case, that argument that they make is completely counterfactual anyway, because world copper demand, actually, I believe it's copper, has a huge, very, very high recyclability, and it's already almost 100% recycled, and
right.
That doesn't alter the fact that demand continues to go up, and
right.
So there is always a new demand for new copper mines. And it's the same with some of the others that whatever the recyclability of steel is, it doesn't alter the fact that new steel has to be brought online because of new demand. And
right.
It's the same with zinc. It's the same with all these that that also ignores the fact that in many of these cases, recycling itself is an incredibly energy intensive and toxic process. That, for example, aluminum recycling is horribly, horribly toxic, and so is steel recycling. They devastate groundwater and devastate the air and devastate the soil. So sorry to interrupt. It's just the whole recycling thing. I mean, of course I recycle as best I can, but that doesn't alter the fact that recycling is still deeply toxic and deeply energy intensive and also completely insufficient. So the argument that they make is not factual.
Right. Definitely. Yeah, so those are some of the most common responses I get. And I think really it just shows how much people have been sold and people have bought into this idea of a technotopia future. You know, a future of just clean green power and electric vehicles everywhere and hydrogen economy and of course it's just complete lies. And anyone who does, you know, half an hour of research will know that it's complete lies, but people don't do that, and I think one of the main reasons is that illusion is comfortable to hold on to. At least if you're relatively wealthy and live in the West.
So are there any other major criticisms of your critique that you've had?
You know, not really. I was a little nervous when I first started preparing for this talk because you're always worried that somebody's going to confront you with just some brilliant counterpoint that you've never thought of before, and you're just going to look like an utter fool in front of the audience, and your work's going to be ruined. But I was very comforted by a friend who said she's been giving talks on agriculture for years and years, and she said, you know, no one's ever done that to me. No one's ever been able to refute the evidence that I present about how agriculture is inherently destructive, because the information is just true. It's irrefutable. And I think that's the case with green technology as well. The evidence is all there and it's very clear. And all you have to do is look at it.
Well, you know, I want to validate that concern about maybe I'm just wrong is something I think we all face. And I know that when I was in my early 30s, I was having a conversation with my friend Jeanette Armstrong, who's a Okanagan writer and activist. Brilliant. She taught me so much, and she continues to teach me. And one of the things that I said to her early on is, so do you ever wonder, you know, since so many people in this culture believe all these things, do you ever wonder that maybe you're just wrong and the culture's right and you're just missing some really obvious facts? And she said, yeah, you know, I used to wonder that once in a while, but I don't anymore because the world's dying. And I see this every day. And, you know, at the time, that was the perfect thing for her to say to me. And I still questioned for several years. And honestly, I don't ask myself that question very often anymore, just because, you know, I see that there aren't any newts in the pond anymore, and there were 10 years ago. And I see all of this, and the obvious, you know, there just aren't any obvious mistakes. And also, you know, frankly, there have been people who have been doing these sort of similar analyses. You know, it's like the thing with the agriculture. You know, you got Edward Hyams with Soil and Civilization 60 years ago, and then you also have the simple fact that, you know, where I live, the Talawa lived here for 12,500 years, and the place was a paradise, and the dominant culture has been here 180 years, and the place is trashed. If you read any account of pretty much anywhere in the world, prior to the beginnings of this culture, they're unbelievable in how fecund and full of life the world was. I just read this book the other day called A Country So Full of Game, and it's written about Iowa, of all places. You know, when you think of Iowa, when I think of Iowa, I think of cornfield. But it ends up that the early European explorers said that was one of the richest, most diverse places that they'd ever seen in their lives. And, you know, it's just so I guess it's just a long way of validating that concern I think we all feel. It's like, you know, there's a lot of people who think that professional football is more important than the real world. So what am I missing?
Right. Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned the Talua, because after I burst people's bubble with this talk, I kind of like to throw them a little bone. And the way that I do it is I talk about other ways of living. And I think there are countless examples of people living without industrial technology and living rich and beautiful lives, largely thanks to good relationships with the land around them. I'm sure the indigenous inhabitants of Iowa, I'm sure it wasn't a mistake that the land was so rich there. I'm sure that the indigenous inhabitants of that area had a long, long history there and had learned how to live in a very beautiful balance with all the other creatures there in a way that would facilitate life for everyone. And so I like to talk about these other ways of living and just mention some of the amazing things. One of the things I mentioned just the other day when I gave this talk was just to mention people in my own family who are keeping alive some of these skills and these traditions that go back a long ways that people have used to survive and to thrive without destroying the land. And the specific skills, my mother and one of my aunts are both potters. And I researched a bit about pottery lately, and the oldest known pottery is 30,000 years old. So pottery works. It doesn't destroy the land. And when you're done with a pot, you can just, you know, toss it over a cliff or something, whatever you want to do with it. And, you know, in a relatively short amount of time, that'll be dirt again. And you can't do that with a wind turbine. Another of my aunts is a basket weaver, and she lives near Seattle. And so she uses cattails and cedar bark and roots from various trees and some seaweeds and such. And she weaves these just beautiful baskets. And, of course, if you read about the traditional basketry techniques of Pacific Northwest indigenous people, it's just shocking the first time you read about it, because just using these all natural materials, you can create waterproof garments. You can create, soft cradles for a baby to sleep in. You can create waterproof baskets that you can cook in using hot rocks. You can make sleeping mats. You can make backpacks. It's really just stunning. And I think that a lot of the reason that people feel so attached to this way of life is because they have a very false worldview that tells them before industrial technology, people lived, you know, in the dirt and lived terrible lives. And, you know, if you look at the actual information, if you look into anthropology, if, God forbid, you actually visit an indigenous community and talk to indigenous people, you will very shortly find that that's not the case at all.
So now we come to the question I asked minutes ago, and this will be the last major question. So what do you actually want people to do? They get done listening to this interview, and it's like, okay, so wind energy has some problems, and it causes problems down in Brazil, and also the solar energy kills birds and kills desert tortoises. So what do you want me to do with this information? What should I do now?
Right. Well, the great thing about a radical analysis is that you can pretty much take the same template and apply it anywhere. So once you have a sort of deep understanding of why green technologies aren't going to work, you can take that same analysis and apply it to capitalism.
Wait, back
or
up.
Apply it to agriculture.
Back up a second. What do you mean specifically by radical analysis in this case? What is your radical analysis of wind energy? Does that just mean looking at context? Looking at not just looking at the energy produced, but instead looking at what goes into it and what comes out? What do you mean by radical?
Yeah, the root of the word radical means root. It means to get to the root of the problem. And so you could just say a full accounting if you're into a more capitalistic language, perhaps. If you do a full accounting of these green technologies, you'll very quickly see that they're not sustainable. They perpetuate injustice. They play into the same global power structures of capitalism and modern-day colonial exploitation of poor nations and poor peoples, and et cetera. So you can apply that same sort of deep thinking and analyzing the structure of different systems, as I mentioned, like capitalism, like agriculture, and you'll find that, as you've talked about with many of the other guests on your shows and in your books, that the same is largely true. Capitalism is destroying the planet. It's impoverishing people. It's killing people. The same is true of, you know, modern-day imperialism, of a lot of the structures that are in power around the world. And so I actually work with a group called Deep Green Resistance, which is based on the book that you co-wrote. And we have a much broader analysis that takes into account a lot of these issues and comes to the conclusion that industrial civilization is completely unsustainable as a way of life, that the timeline for making change, for saving the world, for stopping species extinction and preventing the genocide that goes on every day in this culture, that the timeline of that is very short, and that we need dramatic action very quickly. And so personally, you know, I support anyone who's doing good work. And just this morning, I was reading an email from a person in Nevada who is fighting fracking there. And he was sending out an email encouraging people to attend these public hearings about fracking and make their voice heard. And I copied his email and I forwarded it to all the people I know in the area. Even though I know that that process is unlikely to result in fracking being halted, because I think that it's important for people to speak out, to find their voices, to attempt to force the democratic system to be partially functional when people can. But I also recognize that, you know, the planet is dying. I think that really hit home for me when a couple of years ago, I went to Siberia, northern Russia, and I was there with a group of climate scientists, and I walked on top of thawing permafrost, and I saw massive riverbanks literally flowing before my eyes, trees falling off the edge as the permafrost thawed and the bank was, you know, just falling away into the river. And that was the warmest year on record in Russia. And so I think we're in a global emergency. And so I think while we need all sorts of involvement, I think that we need more dramatic action. And that's why I support the strategy advocated by Deep Green Resistance, which basically revolves around using militant strikes on industrial infrastructure to physically stop the global economy from functioning.
And it seems to me that the first step toward doing that is to
decisively transfer one's allegiance and loyalty and love away from the industrial capitalist economy and to the real physical world and the non-humans who are your neighbors.
Right. Yeah, and that's what I was thinking yesterday when I saw that Peregrine Falcon fly overhead. I think that that is a critical step. I think that once you have begun to engage in that process, that you'll find that resistance becomes much easier, and indeed, you know, stops being a burden or an obligation or something that you force yourself to do, and instead starts being a pleasure. And perhaps not a pleasure, because it's never a pleasure to defend those you love from violence, but it does feel good, and it does feel right.
Well, thank you so much, Max, and I would like to thank the listeners for listening, and my guest today has been Max Wilbert. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.